Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. Today, I'm very pleased to have a special guest, Paul Hoggett. Paul is a psychoanalytic psychotherapist and is Emeritus Professor of Social Policy at UWE Bristol, where, with Simon Clark, he was Director of the Centre for Psychosocial Studies. In 2000, with Larry Gold, he was founding editor of the Journal of Organisational and Social Dynamics. And in 2012, with Agent Tate, he founded the Climate Psychology Alliance, the CPA, and was its first chair. Paul has authored many books and papers on psychosocial issues and latterly on climate psychology. Paul, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Good to see you.
Good, yeah, and you. I was just looking through your bio and remembering that my first encounter with you was through your book, The Partisans in an Uncertain World.
Yeah.
I thought it was my first exposure to psychosocial thinking, and it was like, wow, this is great. So thank you for that. So we're here to talk about the climate and climate change and climate psychology. What's your, where are you with that at the moment? It's kind of, you've been involved in it for quite a while now, and you set up the Climate Psychology Alliance. What's on top of your mind and agenda at the moment in relation to the climate crisis we're facing?
Climate delay, I think, is the thing that's on my mind at the moment. So we've got through climate denial, that kind of very overt kind of resistance. And we've also got through some aspects of knowing about it and resisting doing anything about it. And I think in a certain sort of way, we're reaching a point whereby there's a kind of knowing or deliberate delay that we're having to contend with now. And I suppose it's a problem of liberal democracy in a way. Many of the people who crucially need to implement the policies we need at the present moment in time know that they're not going to be there even in 2030,
yeah,
when the key issues are going to come to the fore. So it's the short-termism, you know, that's the problem. They don't see the urgency because they're not going to be held responsible.
Yeah. I listened to Greta Thunberg yesterday with her blah, blah, blah speech. Mm-hmm. And, powerfully kind of bringing that up. But there's the political side of it. So the people wanting to retain short-term power and just focusing on their own terms of office. But your focus is well on the psychological and psychosocial side of it. What do you think is happening in people's minds around resistances and engagement with the climate crisis? What's your kind of thinking on that?
Well, it's a very complex and multifaceted thing. It's interesting you mentioned partisans because I'm just in the process of writing a book at the moment, sort of bringing together various talks and workshops I've run over the last 10 years in this area of climate psychology. And so I went back and started reading partisans. I mean, it's like a band, you know, a rock band that peaked.
Yeah.
And you never quite reach that point again. So I always look on that book with great fondness. And, you know, one of the key themes in it, even then, even before I was particularly aware of climate change, was the the many subtle ways in which we moderns are enveloped in a kind of cocoon,
mm-hmm.
a cocoon of everyday routines, of living, of comforts, and so on, which mean that we're able to live in this world where, because of mass media and now social media, we know about all these terrible things going on, and yet somehow or other remain unaffected. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So long as we remain unaffected, our knowledge of these things remains just that, a kind of abstract intellectual knowledge, which doesn't disturb, which doesn't affect us, and which doesn't motivate us. And that theme really was key theme in Partisans back in 1992, when I had very different kinds of threats in mind than climate change today. But I think the same thing still operates in many ways.
Yeah, the idea of cocooning is very powerful, actually. And it's, you know, we see social media has amplified that as well, where you get cocooned into your subgroups and your...
Absolutely, yeah.
And your points of view. That's very helpful. Yeah, it's interesting you talk about modernity and us moderns. I'm constantly talking about moderns and modernity at the moment, because it seems to me that is the entrapment. It's like a way of being which we accept as it's kind of normative. But it actually isn't. It's a particular kind of way of thinking, which is kind of linear, machine-like, and cocoon-like, and vision, all about kind of categorization. And that's a huge problem when we're trying to think systemically and connectively and in different ways. I think the modern kind of mindset is a huge kind of problem to achieving what we need to achieve.
Yes. Yeah. And I agree. And I think I've been very interested to kind of try and understand where it comes from and how far it goes back. And, you know, in a way, Simon, I think it is linked to the foundation of Judeo-Christian civilization. You think all the seeds of what we call modernity can be found there. And so I think those founding myths of our civilization, particularly, you know, the Garden of Eden, the fall, Tree of Knowledge, all those kinds of things are kind of at a very deep level crucial to understanding what modernity and we moderns are all about. You know, ultimately, I think we're still looking for paradise and still in some kind of trauma from the fall.
I agree, and it's that universality as well, like, you know, there is only one God and one way,
and and it's very distinctive. I mean, interestingly enough, it is shared by Islam, but yes. If you look at most other world religions, they're not monotheistic. Many of them are polytheistic. It's very interesting that it's just Judeo-Christian civilization and Islam, you know, which kind of a monotheistic in this way, and they all believe in paradise.
Yeah, that's right. And I actually teach on an interfaith course with Krish Ravel, a friend of mine who's a Hindu, and but he brings the Abrahamic faith together, and it's a Christian and Muslims come together, the different leaders from those traditions in the UK. And it's very interesting, and they read the scriptures from different perspectives, but it is that same monolithic kind of way of thinking and belief systems. I'm actually been in touch with the Indigenous and First Peoples culture recently, and again, it's a very different way of thinking. It's much more kind of entangled. One thing about modernity I'm focusing on is how, drawing on Weber, he talks about the disenchanted world. And I think that's right. It's like, but when we disenchanted the world, when the spirit world kind of came out of the material world, so we stopped thinking about trees and nature and material things around us as kind of part of us, as kind of with a living spirit. Of course, there was kind of a lot of problems with that as well, in the sense of, you know, people kind of... put powerful spells on other people, and there's a whole kind of I'm not idealizing that, but that way of thinking brought us out, like through us, it's like being thrown out of the Garden of Eden, threw us out of nature as well. And that disenchantment has stayed with us. And although people are comfortable in their cocoons, not that content in their cocoons. There's like a discontent and a disenchantment.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, that's precisely the discontent, that sense of longing, which keeps the engines of growth going.
Yes.
You know, that's the problem. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think that modern way of being and state of mind is founded on these kinds of separations and splittings.
Yeah.
And one of the most fundamental ones is, as you say, human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that split between human and nature, as if we don't have bodies ourselves,
yeah.
As if we're not of nature, thoroughly natural beings, you know?
Yeah, and it's a very human-centric, I mean, our view of the world, I mean, even myself, I tried for like the last, I don't know how long, to try and sort of embrace a kind of ecological, systemic kind of way of being and view, and I'm sure I'm further down the road than some people. But I catch myself and I'm, you know, modernity, you can't escape it. Like you are a part of it and you know, I still think in a human-centric way when I, you know, I'm trying to think in a multi-species way and an engaged way, but we still kind of put ourselves on top of that pyramid and in a way which is actually very unhelpful. And yeah, I notice it all around me.
Mm. And the consequences of that are all around us, you know, you know, we call it the revenge of Gaia, but nature is forcing itself back upon us. We've regarded her as this kind of strange backdrop to the stage,
yes.
Which we just don't see. It doesn't impact upon the stage. And, you know, now it is, I mean, this is a metaphor used by a French sociologist called Bruno Latour. Now the backdrop is crowding in on the stage and pushing the main actors off it, yeah? And that's the price of ignoring it for so long.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and no, I read a lot of Latour's work, very very helpful. I began reading his Actor Network Theory first.
Oh, yeah.
Lancaster, and that was really helpful to kind of, again, displace humans as kind of the mm-hmm. center of everything and think about how machines and technologies and the environment around us, we're also agents in our world.
So yeah.
Very, very helpful. Mm. And what kind of work are you doing in the Climate Psychology Alliance? What sort of work are you doing there to work on these issues?
Over the last, I suppose, two and a half years, the Alliance has really done a lot of its practical work, its interventions, if you like, in this field of climate, what's become known as climate anxiety.
Yeah.
Which is the journalists have really kind of leapt on this and invented this term. But, this has become the big thing. I mean, really, there's been a huge awakening to the climate crisis in the last 2.5 years. And there are a number of factors that contributed to that. But crucially, I suppose, the wildfires, particularly in Australia and then in California. And then Greta came along. Mm-hmm. I think they were two really important triggering factors. So we suddenly found, about 2.5 years ago, everything suddenly grew dramatically. And the Alliance grew dramatically, and we became increasingly involved in doing work around climate anxiety, so setting up a free kind of therapeutic support service, and then starting to do a lot of work with children, both practical work helping with schools, but also research work, major research project, largely through Caroline Hickman at University of Bath and others, which has just published a big multinational piece of research about a month ago on the experiences of children and young people of climate change. So that's become a really big area over the last 2.5 years. But we've tried to kind of keep our thinking work going alongside our practical interventions at the same time. Sally Weintraub's book came out earlier this year, and four of us who've been very involved with the CPA have got a book coming out with Phoenix in the early part of next year, where we're trying to push forward our thinking on some of these issues as well.
It's interesting. I've been reading Donna Haraway as well quite a bit, and she talks about the dangers of becoming a doomster as well. So you could fall into kind of the modernity trap of looking for salvation, or just proclaiming we're all in hell, and raising the anxieties and stuff. How do you think we can manage this without just creating a kind of a therapeutic project, or kind of turning it into kind of a human kind of our needs? How do we keep it alive to keep hope alive when we're facing with a crisis and allow change to take place?
Well, this has been a kind of issue that we've faced all the way through since the Alliance was formed. One of our first big conferences was called Radical Hope. And we drew very much on the work of Jonathan Lear, the psychoanalyst Jonathan Lear, who wrote that brilliant book called Radical Hope, which is really trying to understand the nature of how you combine facing difficult truths, which is our strapline, you know, climate psychology, facing difficult truth, how you combine facing difficult truths with keeping what a lot of people talk about as the need for hope going. Now, I think our point of view is that hope is not something you can have. It's not something that you can grow in some kind of bag. There are a number of techniques for growing it. Hope is essentially something you do. And you do it because it's about other qualities, other virtues, in particular virtues like courage, persistence, things we're very familiar with in our world, negative capability, staying with the uncertainty. Those are the kinds of things that keep what I would call radical hope. They're the basis of radical hope. So, this is something we've thought about and talked about a lot in climate psychology, and keep talking about it, because it's so easy to fall into that binary that you mentioned of either doomism on the one hand or pure wishful thinking on the other.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there's many dangers in this. You can become very tribal in it. And I've been on demos and stuff where, you know, people are very tribal in their beliefs, and we very quickly get a bad other, you know, so the bad other politician, or, you know, we can enjoy our activism too much, in the sense that we become just protesters who bathe in the anger or whatever. I that's why I like Haraway's work, because that idea of staying with the trouble, really, really nice. And using storytelling and not repairing or making good, but kind of finding new ways to live and die in this.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we sometimes talk about, you know, almost like, well, you've got to come out of disavowal. So you've got to not just intellectually know about this, you've got to be moved and disturbed and affected by it. So that it affects your motivation. Okay. But once you do that, then you've got to stay with the trouble, the troubling feelings and emotions that this inevitably is going to arouse inside you. And that's the key thing, really, to do that. I think, you know, some of the modern protest movements adopt many of these kinds of principles unwittingly, really. And one of the big things about XR is, and it's integral to many of their actions, you've got to avoid the idea of having an outcome in mind. Which I think is really important, because conventional models of hope say, you've got to have a goal and objective, you know, that you've got to achieve and strive towards. This is what hope is all about. And they don't. They eschew that idea of having an outcome in mind. so that I think that's a really important element. We adopt it even in terms of the way in which we talk about climate conversations, because we do a lot of workshops around how do you have difficult conversations about climate change. And one of the first things we say is, if you go into a conversation about climate change, don't go into it with an outcome in mind, because that will destroy it from the very beginning.
No, it's very important. I mean, I run a coaching program, and it's like right at the beginning of it, it's like, okay, put goals aside, put targets aside, and it creates a different space to work in completely. And what emerges from that space can be far more powerful and far more
interesting. What a genuine dialogue.
Yeah. And powerful transitions in people and new ideas come from that space. Whereas if I start off with a Zen poem, if you point your cart north when you want to go south, how will you arrive?
Mm-hmm.
That's from Ryokan. And it's that idea, if you set a goal, then kind of like 2 years down the road, you think, oops, we're on the wrong direction. Like, you know, it's too linear. It's modern thinking. It's very linear, isn't it? It's kind of like, you know, it shuts things down. It categorizes it. It puts limits on it right from the beginning. And it doesn't allow that ambiguity, that ambivalence, that staying with not knowing to do the work. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I may, fortunately, I don't think we thought about it, but we never had an outcome in mind when we set up the Climate Psychology Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been fascinating to see how it's grown.
Yeah.
And, you know, Adrian and I are now very much taking a back seat, and we've got a new group of people now running it and, you know, pushing it forward and so on. And it's, you know, you just watch it go into unexpected areas, and it's more like improvisation. We often talk about it being more like collective improvisation than a kind of the modern idea of goals, targets, you know, plans, strategies, and so on and so forth.
Did you ever read Albert Malouche's work, Nomads of the Present, on social movements?
I think I read a few pages and then gave up.
Okay. I mean, a big influence on me, because he talks about kind of old social movements, like you say, looking for material gains. They want a 5% wage increase, or they want better conditions for workers, and new social movements talking about enacting the way the world should be. You know, they demonstrate to the world kind of how the world should be, and they use paradox and different ways of embodying it. And I think that's kind of what you're saying about Extinction Rebellion, XR, and other organizations, the way they kind of work in that way. And it's,
You know, in my generation, which goes way back to the 1970s, then we used to talk about prefiguration, you know, that you should prefigure in the present what you want to achieve in the past.
Yes.
So you can't engage in actions which organize around a set of principles which aren't what you want to achieve in the future, contrary to what you want to achieve in the future. Easier said than done, of course.
It is, yeah. I mean, putting this stuff into practice, I mean, I'd work with eco-leadership and try and get organizations to think more sustainably, to work in a more ethical way. And what I say to them is that this is not just kind of an altruistic kind of way of being. It's actually, you know, you need to be adaptive. You need to kind of be more fluid. You need to have distributed leadership in order to survive, let alone kind of do good in the world. And it's very interesting that organizations get this now. I mean, when I used to start this, I would be a very marginal voice in the organizational world. And now people talk about ecosystems all the time, business ecosystems, natural ecosystems. But what they find very, very difficult is that shift from a human-centric kind of therapeutic culture way of changing. So they slip very quickly into, we need more compassionate leaders, more authentic leaders. They slip into this language and find it very difficult to hold on to that systemic piece, that ecosystems piece. How do we connect to wider systems? How do we connect to others in our organization? It's quite interesting how we're, I guess it goes back to your original point, really, how we get very caught in clusters and in boundary groups.
Mm. Well, you know, one of the problems I find increasingly, Simon, is both governments, the media, and organizations, the use of weasel words.
Yes.
You know, what I call weasel words, yes. You know, and it's become, that's one of the problems we've got. Green has become so fashionable.
Yeah.
That, you know, everybody, you know, wants to adopt the language of green, including green airports, for God's sake. You know, I've just been last week, there's a planning inquiry into the expansion of Bristol Airport, and part of the rhetoric of those pushing for the expansion is that this will be a green airport with zero carbons, you know, as if as if its whole business is not actually facilitating high carbon forms of living. So, I take what you say, but one of the things I think we're constantly now having to struggle with is the slipperiness of language.
Yes. I'm thinking that language is actually very important. You go back to Foucault about language, knowledge and power and discourses, the power of discourses. And it is very important, isn't it? We do have to kind of challenge rhetoric, challenge kind of greenwashing, think about the language you use. Mm. Again, going back to Haraway, the language she uses, I mean, sometimes it's over complex, but it actually is offering languages and stories are going to be hugely important in this work, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and change does happen and is happening. And they, and it's, and I find myself having to sort of be cautious and think, is this real or not? Am I being taken in or not? But if you take someone like BP, it does look as if they are, at last, making a real attempt to make a transition away from an oil-dependent notion of what energy is all about. Of course, they said they were doing this about 20 years ago when they tried to rename BP Beyond Petroleum. It turned out to be a big con. But this time it does look as if they're actually doing real stuff, and making real changes. But I always have to be hesitant because, you know, the capitalism has an infinite capacity for self-deception. And that's why I always feel you have to be hesitant.
Yeah, well, we do have to be hesitant, but I think things are happening, and it's interesting. Like, it's not just been driven by altruistics; it's been driven. We know that regulations are coming down the road, fires are coming down the road. I mean, I work with in the finance sector as well, and you know, there's a kind of an anxiety around the speed of change, and unless they get on board, you know, shareholders are moving money towards kind of more sustainable kind of projects. There's fintech coming along. It's interesting. And I also, you know, I'm working in Ford Motor Cars, and that's fascinating because they're interested in the ideas of eco-leadership. And you read yesterday that, you know, that they've just invested $11 billion in new electric cars.
Yeah.
And they know that they're out of the game unless they kind of go electric, catch up.
Well, that whole automotive sector is a really interesting example of change now, which was inconceivable only 5 or 6 years ago, in actual fact.
So there is change. So we'll end on something a bit hopeful for our audience. That's good. I ask all guests if they have any thoughts on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society, Paul. Any thoughts from your deep experience?
A phrase which was used in a book by, I've forgotten his name now, who's a humanistic psychologist about 25 years ago. He's dead now, but he wrote a book called Ordinary Ecstasy. I didn't rate the book, but I think it's a brilliant idea. Yeah. The importance and the centrality of ordinary pleasures, ordinary lives, ordinary things, I think is absolutely vital for us to begin to reestablish a way of being in the world which is non-destructive, and in which that constant longing of the modern is kind of put to rest.
Yeah, yeah. That's very, very helpful. And then that aligns to something which happened to me. I make green bean chutney every year in memory of my past mother. Like, you know, you burn around the beans. And I just decided to post this on LinkedIn. And it's like, it's an ordinary thing, you know, and it takes me away from modernity and it connects me to my lost generation and stuff. And it's, and I pass on to my children. And it's really funny. Like, you know, I got over like 6,000 people kind of like hitting on this, like, you know, which is kind of, and it's like, say, something about the ordinary, just yeah, kind of there, kind of really spoke to people. So I think you've made a great point there. So listen, it's been a lovely conversation. Thank you very much.
Okay, Simon. Yeah, good to speak to you.
Farewell. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. We'd also like to thank our sponsoring organization, the Eco Leadership Institute. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more about related events, our coach and leadership training, or our webinars, contact Simon at analyticnetwork.com or go to www.eco-leadership.institute. Thank you for listening.